From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is taking the steps to trigger the impeachment trial of President Trump. You can follow NPR's special coverage of the events today at capradio.org. Last night, two women, four men, all Democrats who want to be president, debated again. Candidates Warren, Steyer, Sanders, Klobuchar, Buttigieg, and Biden were all on stage in Des Moines, Iowa. And the Iowa caucuses, which start the election season, you probably know, are February 3rd. Then on March 3rd, it's California's turn with a primary that this year is earlier than recent years, and it's on a Super Tuesday. Voter registration is high. So who's planning to vote? In the studio with me, Dr. Mindy Romero, with some voter analysis and predictions. She is with the California Civic Engagement Project at USC's Price School of Public Policy in Sacramento. Hi, Mindy. Glad to have you back here.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
So California's primary is early. We've been told that voter registration is high, and we're in the midst of a presidential impeachment. How much does that change what you might project or expect from a presidential election year?
Well, it puts a lot of question marks in terms of what we anticipate, certainly. I think the impeachment, although many folks understand probably what the outcome will be, certainly the process itself, the news coverage, how that unfolds, I think politically could have impacts, at least for some voters. The very fact that it's an early primary itself that is on Super Tuesday. The idea of moving the primary up in California was one in part to give us more influence nationally in the primary candidate selection, but also that competition, bringing that to California, bringing that the interest, the money, the all the campaigning that we hope to see. We haven't seen as much as we would like to have seen by now, but that hopefully will increase interest, just being a competitive election. And then, of course, the greater environment that we're in right now, where so many folks are following politics, not everyone, that feel very deeply about participating and feel that the election and the primary itself is very consequential.
How much has the California primary moved around on the calendar historically?
It's moved around quite a lot. So we've had a number of years where we were March, June, February, in 2008, we had a February primary, which, by the way, was the highest primary turnout that we saw since 1980. Hmm. So this is not new for us to be in March, but after a number of elections where we had very, very low turnout, the idea was that we would hopefully encourage turnout further and be more influential.
You just said 2016 was the highest, or the February?
February 2008.
2008.
Was the highest. Right. Hopefully I said that right.
Yeah.
Was the highest since 1980 for a primary period.
In the analysis, what do you think drove that year? Was it the candidates? Was it a President Obama? Was it a different kind of candidate in the race?
And by the way, since you mentioned 2016, that's the second highest that we've seen since 1980. Mm. So we're coming right off of the 2016 election. I think in 2008, certainly we had a lot of momentum in this state around the candidacy of Obama. Clinton won, but it was a very competitive primary, actually lengthened her time and her viability for longer in the Democratic primary race. So I think there was interest, there was money, there was a lot of attention nationally. It was early, and because it was so early, it also made it more consequential for many California voters and also received more notice, right? People understood that there was a primary and it mattered. Of course, primaries matter for lots of other reasons besides the presidential, but that was a presidential-only primary at the time.
Say something about that. Because sometimes the primary turnout is dramatically lower than the general election turnout.
I'm glad you said that. So, yes, always primaries are lower than general elections, or almost always they're lower than general elections. So we have decisions that are being made right for the November ballot by a subset. So turnout is low in the United States, period, but very low in primaries. And it's particularly not representative of the rest of the population. So it's more likely when you're looking at the primary turnout, and very much so if it's low primary turnout, if it's historically low, you're looking at a whiter, older, usually higher income, more educated electorate. When primary turnout is higher, what we can, it just historically so, right? It's never very high, but when it's higher for a primary, then we typically see a little bit more representation. So like in 2016, for instance, again, the most recent, the one that we're going to compare when we think about March, we saw the second highest since 1980 turnout, and we saw the representation gap narrow a little bit between the rest of the electorate, between Latinos, Asian Americans, young people, those groups that are historically underrepresented, and actually their share of the vote was historically high, even higher than in 2008, and that was quite exciting to see. So in 2020, in March, we're expecting, I think everyone's expecting high turnout, given the environment that we're in, given the early primary and the competition that's going to be, that is present. So if we have a high turnout, if it's higher than 2016, I don't think it's going to be higher than 2008, although I hope I'm wrong about that. But if it's higher than 2016, which is a very good possibility, then we should see a more representative electorate. But turnout in 2016 was still only about 34%. The second highest since 1980, it was 34%.
Surprising, isn't it?
23% for Latinos, about 20% for Asian Americans, 17% for our young people age 18 to 24. So high is still not where I'm sure all of us want to be. And considering the consequential nature of this primary in particular, again, how everyone's feeling, we hope it is higher than 2008.
And yet the Secretary of State has told us that nearly 80% of eligible voters are registered. Something is motivating people to register. Registration's real high, but translating a registration to an actual vote, what happens?
Well, and also, we shouldn't forget that we now have automatic voter registration in California. So I think we're seeing people that are motivated to participate, that are being mobilized, certainly in registering on their own. And then there's a lot of folks, as the law intended, that are being registered as they go through the DMV process, right? So yes, absolutely. It's because somebody's registered, they still need to be mobilized to vote on election day. Or if you're in a Voter's Choice Act county like Sacramento, of course, you can vote up to 11 days, right, in person, or you can turn your vote-by-mail ballot in any time after you receive it. Particularly for groups that are historically underrepresented, new voters, if they've registered because they intend to vote in the election, that's great. Still can't take that for granted. But if you registered through automatic voter registration, you have to make sure that you're aware of it, right, and then be mobilized to, again, think about, well, now that I'm registered, again, why is the act of voting important to me? That case still has to be made. And we have a lot of young people that pre-registered in California now
because
of the new law,
16 and 17-year-olds,
which is really exciting. But we also can't take that for granted because when did they register? Was it a year ago? Was it 2 months ago? Was their registration tied to the thought of this election and this primary and that they wanted to participate specifically and have a voice? So they need to be mobilized and outreach too. We also have same-day registration in California.
Right.
And in this election, it's going to be available not only at every voting center, but also at every polling place, which we didn't have last election. You had to go, if you were in a non-Voters Choice Act county, traditional polling places, you'd have to go to your registrar's office, at least almost everybody did, to register on election day. Now you can register at any polling place. That is an incredible mobilizing tool. But people need to be aware of it. But imagine young people that you know in your family or in your neighborhood, particularly. You get to them, you talk to them in the past, you maybe made the case for voting or they got excited about voting, they felt comfortable or confident about voting, but then they realized it was past the registration deadline.
Mm-hmm.
Now they can register.
Yeah, I'm imagining someone seeing someone else's I voted sticker.
Yeah.
And realizing, oh, today's an election day, I'm going to get down there and cast my ballot and they can make sure they're registered on that day. I'm talking with Dr. Mindy Romero. She is with the California Civic Engagement Project at USC's Price School of Public Policy in Sacramento. So Dr. Romero, just anecdotally, how do you hear voters talking about this election? What do you hear in tone, in the level of engagement, in the words that they use?
Sure. Of course, I'm a researcher, so anecdotally it's dangerous.
I know. That's why this question's so interesting for me to ask you.
I will say that I do hear, I think many of us hear, a lot of excitement about this election. I don't know if excitement is quite the right word because there's also a lot of fear and concern and, again, feeling it's consequential. So they want to be involved. Folks want to be involved. That being said, I think that we still have a tremendous information gap, even in this information age in our country, when it comes to voter information, feeling comfortable and confident about the candidates, about the issues, knowing which candidates support which issues you care about, all those sorts of things. And particularly, remember we were talking about how turnout is so low, right, in primaries, and underrepresented groups usually it's even lower, and there's a wider representation gap. So all those new voters that we hope will come out, that we expect will come out, need to feel confident. And I think what we're hearing from oftentimes are the voters that are already planning to participate, that are getting additionally motivated. We know that there are new voters that are getting motivated, that are feeling really passionate, but we need to make sure that we aren't kind of taking all of that for granted and understanding there's a lot of voters that could be mobilized, that could, that maybe always vote in generals, for instance, but never vote in a primary, right? That happens a lot. Making sure that they may feel very passionate, but we still need to make the case for why the primary election specifically is important and making sure that they feel armed with the right information, right, to make that, make those decisions, those important decisions.
Young people did have a pretty strong showing in primary voting, though, correct?
In 2016, yes. So, again, their turnout was still much lower, 17% in 2016, eligible youth age 18 to 24, we should probably define that. Those that were citizen eligible, but compare that to 34% for the general population. So they closed the gap. That's the easiest way that I can say, you know, and they were represented more in that election, even though they had declining population numbers. In our state, we're getting older, and it means we're also losing, you know, we're having fewer young people. So that was exciting, but there's still a large, you know, cavern to to traverse or to a large hill to climb, if you will. I think the anticipation is high for March, but we need to make sure we're just supporting those young voters to make sure that they do feel comfortable about transitioning into voting itself. Like you said, if they're registered, that doesn't mean necessarily they will vote. They may care and follow the issues, but
I mentioned the debates last night, and the field of Democrats running for this race is still fairly sizable. Mm-hmm. There are two, three, you might argue, maybe four at the top, maybe fewer at the top in California. Is there enough energy being generated in the Democratic side of the debate to want people to vote in the primary because they're aware that these candidates are still really battling it out and may continue to battle it out until the convention or into the convention?
Yeah, maybe I'll take it from a California-specific position. You know, as we spoke about the shift, why we shifted to the early primary, a big reason was to have greater influence. There was an expectation that we would see candidates in California that we never see candidates usually in our June primary. The other thing about 2016, of course, is that we did have a competition between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, that competition helped. And we normally never have that in June, that late stage. So we expected a competitive primary would bring attention, would bring media coverage, would bring money, mobilizing effort, all those sorts of things. We haven't seen as much as I would have thought we would have seen. I think many of us would have seen. So we've had some candidates visit us a number of times. But the reality is we still have the current system. We still have the Iowa caucus, right? We still have states before California that are absolutely consequential in terms of the media coverage. The race, there are candidates that may drop out between February 3rd
and
March 3rd.
Oh, and some people will tell you California just won't matter this year.
So it's Super Tuesday, but there still is, you still have to get to Super Tuesday. And
Super Tuesday means that eight different states, I believe, are voting on the same day, holding their primaries or caucuses.
Thank you. A number of states, including Texas. Mm. So the attention and resources and energy of candidates are split now with, you know, amongst an even greater number of residents and states. So I'm disappointed we haven't seen, because, again, this is good for voters to have more candidates in the state, especially new voters, to be able to ask questions, to be able to understand, learn about the candidates, to be reminded there's an election, to feel like it's competitive, feel like it's consequential for them if they haven't come to that conclusion yet. But the systems, the way that we carry out our primaries still very much benefits, right, those early states. And hopefully we'll see some changes between now and March 3rd, or more activity, I should say. And I imagine we will to some degree.
I am not going to ask you to look ahead to the general election because you have a number of research projects between now and then, and we'll have you back in the studio to talk more, and we'll know a lot more after the primary.
We will. A good primary doesn't guarantee a strong turnout in November, but it certainly is a helpful indicator. And we have ourselves, as you said, my center, the California Civic Engagement Project, is working on a number of research projects, particularly looking at the impact of all of these new election reforms in California. How do they impact, speaking of voters' confidence and information, how do they impact the accessibility of the voting process for voters, the amount of information that they have? Will some potentially inadvertently create confusion? Will voters be able to understand all their changes, take advantage of all of those new options that are available to them? So lots of questions about how those election reforms are going to positively impact
the
experience.
Thank you, then, just for now. I appreciate having you here, Mindy. Dr. Mindy Romero is Executive Director of the California Civic Engagement Project at USC's Price School of Public Policy in Sacramento. See you again very soon.
Thank you again for having me.
You can find a link to the latest report by CCEP at capradio.org/insight. We are not done, though, with civics class for today. The next topic is grand jury service, and that's coming up after a short break. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio.